I've been given the title Knowledge of the Heart in John Henry Newman. And I'm going to assume that most of you have no close acquaintance with John Henry Newman, his thought, his place in the 19th century. You correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I'm going on the assumption that I've got the task here of introducing him to you. And so I thought a good way of giving you a kind of first orientation with respect to Newman is to set him in relation to some other thinkers whom you will, I think, know. So Newman has often been compared with St. Augustine. You know how in the Confessions, Augustine explores the inner man, the innermost motives of himself, the realms of memory, the experience of time. And you know how Augustine says that this inner world is so much vaster and more fascinating than the outer world of nature. Some say that Augustine is the first modern man because of this turn to the inner self. Well, in Newman, too, there is an exceptionally rich interiority or subjectivity so that he is often treated as an eminently Augustinian thinker. Now, if we look among modern thinkers for some special kinship with Newman, I would first of all name Pascal, a great 17th century French religious writer. Newman is like Pascal in having a strong sense of the limits of human knowledge, and in avoiding all rationalistic overconfidence in human reason. Newman is like Pascal in saying that we need more than just the intellect to find our way in the most important questions. We also need the will and the heart. And so in this lecture, we'll explore the heart in Newman, and we'll find in him the same spirit that Pascal famously expresses when he says, "The heart has its reasons, of which reason knows nothing." And finally, I would mention among the intellectual kin of Newman, the great Kierkegaard, a contemporary of Newman in the 19th century. You know how Kierkegaard turned away from all abstract and systematic knowledge towards existential knowledge. That is, towards knowledge that one can live by and die for. Well, Newman shares the same critical distance to abstract thought, and his works abound in deep existential knowledge. Like Kierkegaard, Newman never wanted to appeal to the intellect alone, but to the whole living man or woman. So Newman is like the existentialists who come out of Kierkegaard in refusing to turn everything into an object of knowledge, and like them in speaking from the heart. So we have then Augustine, Pascal, Kierkegaard as seminal Christian thinkers, and Newman is working along their line. So that by way just of giving you an initial sense of Newman. Now perhaps I should just say a word about his life. He was born in 1801 in London. He underwent a profound conversion to God at the age of 15, a conversion that somehow set his whole life's course. He studied at Oxford, was ordained an Anglican clergyman. His extraordinary literary abilities were very soon in evidence. And he became, in Oxford, the leader of this so-called Oxford Movement. It was a movement of religious renewal in the Church of England. And Newman was the heart and soul of the Oxford Movement. But Newman, through that work of attempting to renew the Church of England, was led to the Church of Rome. He converted in 1845, the most significant Catholic convert since the Reformation, and then became, in later years, Cardinal Newman when Pope Leo XIII conferred that honor on him. And he died in 1890, mostly known to his contemporary as one of the most eminent religious figures of the 19th century. Now, to our subject, knowledge of the heart in Newman. I want to introduce you to a significant distinction that Newman made in what is his most philosophical work, entitled The Grammar of Assent. Most of his works are more theological, some are literary. He wrote poems and novels as well. This is his most seminal philosophical work. And in this work, he distinguishes between what he calls notional assent and real assent. We could as well say notional knowing, real knowing. We will find, as we unpack the idea, we will find in real assent this knowledge of the heart that was so important to Newman. And then, having explained that concept of notional and real, I will try to show how his religious commitment was based on this real assent or knowledge of the heart. And finally, at the very end, I'll consider one significant objection that could be raised to Newman. So, let me begin with a passage from an early sermon of Newman's entitled The Immortality of the Soul, in which Newman writes, "In spite of our being able to speak fluently about it, the immortality of the soul, there seems to scarcely room to doubt that the greater number of those who are called Christians in no true sense realize it in their minds at all. Indeed, it is a very difficult thing to bring home to us and to feel that we have souls. And there cannot be a more fatal mistake than to suppose we see what the doctrine means as soon as we can use the words which signify it." End of that quote. So he's saying, it's easy to achieve or give a notional assent to the immortality of the soul, but difficult to realize it, that is, achieve a real assent to it. Now, here is an example of my own, of notional assent passing over into real assent. Take the true proposition that I will one day die. Now, to apprehend that notionally is simply to understand it on the basis of the universal mortality of all living things. So I think all living things, myself included, will one day die. I subsume myself under the universal mortality. But now, suppose I have just gotten an ominous test result from my doctor, aggressive, inoperable cancer. I know that I will soon die. My coming death is no longer abstract, but pierces me with its concreteness. I experience myself not just as a logical part of everyone, but almost as if I were the only human being. I experience my death as something that concerns me personally. I have a real apprehension of it, and I give a real assent to the proposition that I will soon die. I am filled with shuddering, whereas the notional assent leaves me unmoved, almost as if I were just a spectator of my own future death. Now, here is one of Newman's own examples of making the transition from notional to real assent. He writes in The Grammar of Assent, "Let us consider how differently young and old are affected by the words of some classic author, such as Homer or Horace. Passages which to a boy are but rhetorical commonplaces, neither better nor worse than 100 others with which any clever writer might supply, which he gets by heart and thinks very fine, at length come home to him when long years have passed and he has had experience of life, and they pierce him as if he had never before known them with their sad earnestness and vivid exactness. End of that quote. The schoolboy, Newman means, apprehends the true sayings of the classical authors only notionally. But when he has grown up and had some experience of life, he apprehends the same sayings, not notionally, but really, he realizes them. Notice that Newman speaks of the power of real apprehension to pierce the boy, who is now a man. Notional apprehension, by contrast, takes things abstractly and so keeps them at a greater distance from us. It has no power to pierce us. Now, what I'd like to do with these examples of the move from notional to real ascent in front of us is formulate 5 points of contrast between notional and real. And in that way, try to get a better grip on it. And as I proceed through the five, you'll see why this notional, or rather, excuse me, this real understanding is well called a kind of knowledge of the heart. So first, let's begin with a point which is very obvious in the examples I gave. You can't fail to notice the concreteness that belongs to real apprehension or real ascent, and that forms a contrast with the abstractness or generality that belongs to emotional apprehension. See, even though my future death, to go back to that example, is a concrete event, still I don't apprehend it concretely when I apprehend it notionally. Rather, I universalize it. That is, I take my coming death as an instance of human mortality, and I suppress its concrete plenitude. But when I realize this concrete plenitude, my ascent goes from notional to real. That's the first point, this concreteness of real ascent. Now, secondly, instead of real apprehension, Newman often says experiential apprehension. That is, this real encounter is born of an experiential contact with concrete things. Notional apprehension, by contrast, always cuts short experience or bypasses it, keeping concrete things at a certain distance from us. If I virtually deduce my future death from the universal mortality of all human beings, then I can apprehend my death, concrete though it is, without having to encounter it in an experiential way. I can acknowledge it without being troubled by it. Newman often reflects on different ways in which this notional apprehension dries up the experiential fullness of life. Thus, in one place, he explains how surgeons protect themselves against the reality of the dreadful diseases they have to deal with by describing them with abstract Latin and Greek root names. In this case, there's a good reason for letting our notions block out experience. But in other cases, the deliberate use of notional apprehension can be distinctly dishonest, as George Orwell indicates in a famous essay. Orwell not being aware of Newman's work, but making a point that falls right in with what Newman says in that famous essay of Orwell, Politics in the English Language. He writes, defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine-gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification. End of that quote from Orwell. And then he comments, such phraseology is needed if one wants to name things without calling up mental pictures of them. That's Orwell. Or as Newman would put it, if one wants to name things without eliciting any experiential sense of them. That is, without any real apprehension of them. This is a beneficent result for the physicians just mentioned, but a morally very suspect result when it is driven by insincerity, as in the case that Orwell has in mind. Perhaps we could bring in here a pair of terms made famous by a saying of Kant. You know those two terms in Kant, Begriff, which means concept, and Anschauung, which means intuition. Kant said that concepts without intuition are empty, and that intuition without concepts is blind. Famous, often analyzed utterance of Kant. Now these terms, concept and intuition, correspond fairly closely to Newman's notion and experience. Newman is very concerned with avoiding that barrenness that comes from using concepts without sufficient support from intuition. And I might here, for those of you who are students of philosophy, explain just briefly why Newman has often been regarded as a kind of phenomenologist or proto-phenomenologist. I don't know if phenomenology has come up in some of your philosophy classes, but Newman's defense of the rights of experience in connection with apprehension makes for a kinship with the phenomenologists. There's a well-known distinction that was made by Husserl, the founder of phenomenology, that Newman would have found entirely congenial to his own mind. I'm referring to Husserl's distinction between what he called empty and fulfilled intentions of the mind. You see, for Husserl, the mind can pick out facts and refer to them and make inferences from them, but without letting them unfold intuitively or bringing them to evidence. These are the empty intentions of the mind. But if the mind lets things unfold intuitively before itself and lets them become present to itself, then the intentions of the mind, in the language of Husserl, are fulfilled, not empty anymore. And the former intentions, the empty ones, are akin to Newman's notional apprehension. And the latter, the fulfilled intentions of Husserl, akin to Newman's real apprehension. All right, so that's the second feature, this experiential character of real apprehension. And now the third. Newman often calls real assent imaginative. In fact, in earlier drafts of his work, The Grammar of Assent, this was the name that he gave to real assent, imaginative assent. He says that with real assent, we have an image in the imagination, whereas with notional, we have a notion in the intellect. Thus, the real notional contrast can be expressed as a contrast between an imaginative and a purely intellectual apprehension. Now, let me go back to that essay of Orwell just for a moment. to illustrate this imaginative character of real ascent, Orwell performs an interesting experiment there. He takes a well-known verse from the book of Ecclesiastes, and he first gives it to the reader in the venerable old translation. So here is the verse. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. End of that line. Then Orwell rewrites this verse in contemporary English like this. Objective consideration of contemporary phenomena compels the conclusion that success or failure in competitive activities exhibits no tendency to be commensurate with innate capacity, but that a considerable element of the unpredictable must invariably be taken into account. So, in a way, it's the same sentence, but an imaginative element in the poetical original has clearly been sterilized in Orwell's rewrite. In fact, that's just the point. He's making the sterility of this kind of highly notional talk. You might say abstract thinking has somehow extinguished imagination. We could as well say that an experiential element has been dried up by abstract thinking, or we could say a wholesome concreteness has been replaced with an unnatural abstractness. Now, in thinking about the imaginative character of real ascent, one should note that for Newman, image does not mean visual image. It doesn't even mean sensible image. He recognizes all kinds of thoroughly non-sensible images. For instance, he speaks in one place about the image you can form of the mind of St. Augustine from reading his works. So Newman refers here to a concrete sense of Augustine's intellectual style, of the intellectual character that distinguishes Augustine, say, from Aquinas. So if imagination didn't have some more than visual meaning for Newman, he could hardly speak of this imaginative grasp of the difference between these writers, and he certainly couldn't speak, as we'll see later on, of the difference between what he calls the religious imagination and the theological intellect. For, as we'll see, what distinguishes the religious imagination is certainly not the presence of visual images or any kind of sense images. All right, that's the third feature. And here a fourth feature of this contrast between notional and real goes like this. Notional apprehension is experienced as localized in one particular place in human nature, namely in the intellect. Whereas real apprehension is experienced as the work of the whole human being. It involves heart and will, no less than intellect. And here, Newman's thought on real ascent connects with our theme of knowledge of the heart. It is because of this affective impact, that's what Newman wants to capture, there's this affective dimension of real ascent, and this is why real ascent is so much more powerful than notional in moving us to act. We can acknowledge a truth notionally and yet keep it from ever getting close to our behavior, even though it has consequences for our behavior. But real apprehension, since it touches us affectively, has an impact on our behavior. In an often quoted passage from the Grammar of Ascent, Newman says, "The heart is commonly reached and moved to act, not through reason, but through the imagination, by means of direct impressions, by the testimony of facts and events. Persons influence us, voices melt us, looks subdue us, deeds inflame us. So this is real apprehension with its power to move us, that a power that's conspicuously missing in merely notional apprehension. And by the way, you notice that this this aspect of real apprehension was especially important to Newman as a preacher. The concreteness of real apprehension and the experiential character of it and the imaginative character of it are of interest to him insofar as they're related to this power to touch the heart and thereby move persons to action. That's why in that sermon I quoted from the beginning, he says, we have to find a way to realize the immortality of the soul. Otherwise, it remains a dead letter in our religious lives with no power over the conduct of our lives. Then now I come to the fifth and final aspect of real apprehension. And it emerges if we interpret Newman by way of Kierkegaard. So I pick up the thread from the beginning of the lecture. Now, here is a well-known journal entry written by the young Kierkegaard, about your age, 21 he was, in which he deplores a certain kind of intellectual barrenness. Kierkegaard writes, "What would be the use of discovering so-called objective truth, of working through all the systems of philosophy, and being able, if required, to review them all and show up the inconsistencies within each system? What good would it do me to be able to develop a theory of the state and combine all the details into a single whole and so construct a world in which I did not live, but only held up to the view of others? What good would it do me to be able to explain the meaning of Christianity if it had no deeper significance for me and my life? What good would it do me if truth stood before me cold and naked, not caring whether I recognized her or not?" End of that Kierkegaard quote. Kierkegaard says in this journal entry that he's not looking for any such objective truth, but rather for a truth which he goes on to say, by which I can live and die. He calls it, in what follows in this passage, truth which grows together with the deepest roots of my life, through which I am, so to speak, grafted upon the divine. And he says, it is this divine side of man, his inward action, which means everything, not a mass of information. Now, Kierkegaard is called the father of existentialism in philosophy, and we can say that he expresses here a deep aspiration, not for objective truth, but for existential truth. That is, not for truth to be observed in the manner of a spectator, but for truth to be dwelt in, to be lived. Truth that stimulates, as he says, our innermost action. Truth that grows together with the deepest roots of our being. Now, Kierkegaard's, what he calls objective truth, is not hard to find in Newman. Notional apprehension is apprehension of objective truth in the sense of Kierkegaard. Both thinkers are aiming at a truth that, when they talk about objective, that is outside of me, at a distance from me, truth that leaves me cold even when acknowledged. Real apprehension closes this difference, gives me an experiential immediacy to the truth apprehended, and enables the truth to engage me as a whole person. Thus, Newman's real apprehension clearly tends to converge with Kierkegaard's existential truth, as I said at the beginning. Just consider how natural it is to use Kierkegaard's language in interpreting one of the examples given above of notional and real. I can know that I will one day die, and know this on the grounds that every living being in nature dies. Instead of saying that I notionally apprehend my death, one can as well say with Kierkegaard that my death is an objective fact outside of me that fails to engage me in a deep existential way. Suppose I now come to realize my future death in a personal way, shuddering at what awaits me. Instead of saying that I really apprehend my death, one can as well say with Kierkegaard that my death is experienced with existential urgency, that it is experienced as my death, that it creates an earthquake in my subjectivity. You see, the edge of Kierkegaard's existential urgency, as I call it, is a certain relation of me to myself. As he said, what good would it do me to be able to explain the meaning of Christianity if it had no deeper significance for me and my life, if it did not grow together with the deepest roots of my being? Kierkegaard wants to get away from being a mere spectator of truth and to become a full participant in it. Now, it's very helpful to think of Newman's contrast between notional and real in terms of spectator and participant. So in this way, with the help of Kierkegaard, we can develop Newman's contrast a little beyond his own text, his contrast between notional and real. So summing up the 5 points of contrast, then we can say that real apprehension takes things concretely and doesn't lose the concrete in the universal. It has an experiential immediacy and doesn't keep reality at a distance. It is imaginative, in the sense explained. It engages the whole person, touching the heart, moving the person to action, and does not merely engage the intellect. And finally, it has an existential urgency that does not take reality with a detached objectivity, leaving us as mere spectators, but rather draws us in as participants. So, put together these 5 aspects of real apprehension, real assent, and you see why I call it a kind of knowledge of the heart that Newman teaches under in this part of his thought. Now, we come to the next main part, a much shorter part, you'll be relieved to know, of my talk, where we consider how Newman, with respect to our knowledge of God, advances from notional to real. So we want to see the use that Newman makes of this idea of real apprehension, his aspiration for it, the use he makes of that in his understanding of religious commitment. Now, we have to first consider what the notional knowledge of God is, according to Newman. By notional knowledge of God, he would mean what is traditionally called natural theology, with its proofs of the existence of God, along with demonstrations of the main attributes or names of God, such as one, omnipotent, omniscient, and so on. Now, Newman does not reject this traditional approach, but he thinks that it remains too notional. Even if all the formal proofs contained in natural theology are as rationally successful as the theologians claim them to be, They all lead only, human thinks, to a notional apprehension of God. But Newman is looking for a religious knowledge that involves a real apprehension, a realizing of the reality of God. Sometimes he makes a contrast between the theological intellect and the religious imagination, and says that proofs and demonstrations are carried out by the theological intellect, whereas he is concerned with knowledge that appeals to the religious imagination. He is looking for a knowledge of God which is existential knowledge in the Kierkegaardian sense, knowledge that engages the whole person, knowledge that we can live by, knowledge that doesn't just appeal mainly to the intellect. Newman says in one famous passage, I use it as the motto of my book on Newman, he says this in words that are very characteristic of him and could only have been written by him. He says, I am far from denying the real force of the arguments in proof of a God, but these do not warm me or enlighten me. They do not take away the winter of my desolation or make the buds unfold and the leaves grow within me and my moral being rejoice. End of that quote. So he's clearly looking for a kind of religious knowledge that speaks to the heart, not just the mind. A kind of knowledge that has the stamp of the real, not just the notional. So, I will maybe abbreviate a little bit. I was going to quote a passage from Newman describing God as conceived in rational theology and all the different names are ascribed to God, like being truth itself, wisdom, love, justice, holiness, all-powerful, all-knowing, omniscient, incomprehensible. And Newman comments on this product of natural theology, saying that this conception of God follows upon acts of inference and other purely intellectual exercises. It is an ascent to a large development of predicates, watch this expression, drawn out as if on paper, as we might map a country which we have never seen. So, in these words, Newman vividly evokes notional apprehension. It's the apprehension of something you aim at with your mental intention but don't really see and can't fully realize. It's an apprehension based more on concepts and definitions than on the living presence of the reality that is apprehended. So Newman longs, as you saw in that other quote, for a sense of God more than just notional. He then goes on, the question is, can I attain to any more vivid assent to the being of God than that which is given merely to the notions of the intellect? Can I enter with a personal knowledge into the circle of truths which make up that great plot? Can I rise to what I have called an imaginative apprehension of God? Can I believe as if I saw? End of that quote. It would seem that, you know, when Newman asks for this imaginative grasp of God, you would think, well, in the case of God, who is a hidden God, you would think, well, he's only apprehensible in faith. So with God, you would think that, at least in this life, nothing better than notional apprehension is possible. But Newman, not deterred, writes, yet I conceive that a real ascent to God is possible. And I proceed now to show how. So I come to the memorable passage there in chapter 5 of The Grammar of Ascent, where Newman tries to find this real apprehension of the reality of God in our experience of conscience. It is through our sense of being morally obliged, Newman proposes, that we can gain a real apprehension of the reality of God. Newman says, "Were it not for this voice of conscience speaking so clearly in my heart, I should be an atheist or a pantheist or a polytheist when I looked into the world." So Newman's way to God is not cosmological in the sense of starting with the external world and reasoning back to God as the cause of it. Newman's way passes through his moral interiority. So let's see how it works, and you can see if you think this really does awaken some kind of real apprehension of God as Newman claims. Now, to understand how Newman finds God in conscience, we have to make a certain distinction with respect to conscience. There are two senses of it, as he points out. There's first of all conscience in the sense of the mental power by which we understand right and wrong. So, for instance, it's by conscience that I understand that it's wrong to shed innocent blood, wrong to steal what is not mine, wrong to manipulate the truth for my own convenience, wrong to break my word. So those judgments of right and wrong are made by conscience in the first sense. But there's a more proper sense of conscience. This is the one that Newman works with. Suppose I come into a particular situation in which I'm tempted to distort the truth for my own convenience or break my word. And suppose that at this moment I have the strong sense that I must not yield to this temptation. I might say that my conscience warns me not to yield, or that it commands me not to do wrong. The thought of doing wrong fills me with a certain shuddering, and I realize that I will compromise myself in an ultimately serious way if I do the wrong that tempts me. Or suppose I've yielded to the temptation, then I say that my conscience accuses me, and I'm tormented, knowing that it rightly accuses me. Now, this is the second level of conscience, the one with which Newman works. This sense of a kind of imperative voice, warning or accusing. And so Newman says, hence it is that we are accustomed to speak of conscience as a voice, and moreover, a voice or the echo of a voice imperative and constraining like no other dictate in the whole of our experience. End of that quote. So we have conscience as a moral sense by which we come to know the moral law, and we have conscience as a dictate, imperative and constraining, which challenges me in a definite situation. Now, with that distinction made, Newman proceeds to examine the affections, the affective life that goes with conscience in the second sense. And he gives particular attention to the affections that make up a bad conscience. So emotions such as shame, fear, dread, sense of responsibility. But he also gives attention to the positive affections of awe and hope and the peace of mind that make for a so-called good conscience. He then argues that if we draw out the lines of meaning contained in these affections proper to conscience, we can discern in them an interpersonal situation, that is, the encounter with another. He says that conscience, in this second sense, always implies the recognition of a living other towards which it is directed. Inanimate things cannot stir our affections. These are correlative with persons. If, as is the case, Newman goes on, we feel responsibility, are ashamed, are frightened at transgressing the voice of conscience. This implies that there is one to whom we are responsible, before whom we are ashamed, whose claims upon us we fear. These feelings in us require, for their exciting cause, an intelligent being. We are not affectionate toward a stone, nor do we feel shame before a horse or a dog. So there's a certain intersubjectivity, there's a certain encounter with another built into the characteristic affectivity of conscience. Now, many readers might go along with Newman and say, yes, there's that interpersonal dimension, but then they'll want to say, the other whom we encounter in conscience is, after all, only a human other. But Newman proceeds to suggest that the person to whom the affections of conscience refer cannot be a merely human person. And he completes the train of thought like this. And with this we come just about to the end. He says, conscience excites all these painful emotions, confusion, foreboding, self-condemnation. And on the other hand, it sheds upon us a deep peace, a sense of security, a resignation, and a hope, to which there is no sensible, no, not to which, but which there is no sensible, no earthly object to elicit. The wicked flees when no one pursueth. Then why does he flee? Whence his terror? Who is it that sees in solitude, in darkness, in the hidden chambers of his heart? If the cause of these emotions does not belong to the visible world, the object to which his perception is directed must be supernatural and divine. And thus, the phenomena of conscience, as a dictate, the second sense, avail to impress the imagination with the picture, imaginative grasp of a divine governor, a judge, holy, just, powerful, all-seeing, retributive. And it is the creative principle of religion. So note that expression, the creative principle of religion, not the creative principle of theological reflection. This is just the kind of knowledge that Newman seeks, this knowledge that, you might say, engenders religious existence and religious commitment. Newman wants to encounter God in a way that does not just appeal to the theological intellect, but also to the religious imagination and to the heart. And he finds this encounter in conscience. Here he finds that experience of God which, as he says, takes away the winter of his desolation and makes the buds unfold and the leaves grow within him and his moral being rejoice. Now, I had promised also to raise an objection and deal with an objection that could be raised to Newman, but I see the time ticking away, so maybe I'll just call it right here. Perhaps somebody will raise the objection that I was going to raise, and then I'll say what I wanted to say. But it's certainly better that we have time for discussion. I not outwear my welcome by talking at you for too long. So let's stop here and move into some discussion on these issues.